worthwhile. Today's service comes from the UUA online resource, The Church of the Larger Fellowship, otherwise known as the CLF. Due to budget constraints, we will again be using this resource for a few services during the church year. And fortunately, there are a great variety of good sermons to choose from. Hopefully, you will find them enlightening. Barb Adams, member of the LCUUC Worship Committee, will read the sermon written by Reverend Bruce Clear, currently serving at All Souls Church in Indianapolis, Indiana. Reverend Clear obtained a master's degree in political science and worked for 7 years for the Library of Congress before eventually pursuing ministry. He graduated in 1983 with an MA degree in religion from the University of Chicago and a Doctor of Ministry degree from Meadville Theological Seminary. From 1983 to 1993, he was minister of the Servetus Unitarian Fellowship of Vancouver, Washington. He was that congregation's first minister in its 40 years history, and during his tenure, the congregation grew significantly and built a building. Reverend Clear came to All Souls in Indianapolis in 1993 and found a congregation with deep roots and a respected reputation both in the Unitarian Universalist tradition and in the history of the Indianapolis community.
Good morning. The opening words today are from Reverend Bruce Clear, the author of our service today, who was inspired by the book Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic, by Bart Kosko and published first in 1993. It is a very interesting book, and within its pages are gathered some great quotes. To get us started this morning, I will share some of them with you. The first one comes from the Bible. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is new? No, it has already existed long ago before our time. From Aristotle, everything must either be or not be, whether in the present or in the future. From the Buddha, I have not explained that the world is eternal or not eternal. I have not explained that the world is finite or infinite. And last, from Charles Peirce's Dictionary of Philosophy and Psychology, think of armchairs and reading chairs and dining room chairs and kitchen chairs, chairs that pass into benches, chairs that cross the boundary and become settees, dentist chairs, thrones, opera stalls, seats of all sorts, those miraculous fungoid growths that cumber the floor of the arts and craft exhibitions, and you will see what a lax bundle, in fact, is this simple, straightforward term. I would undertake to defeat any definition of chair or chairishness that you gave me. And now our musical prelude. Number 361, enter, rejoice, and come in. Let me stand as you're able.
There are some directions for this.
Thank you, Greg. This morning we will read the chalice lighting and congregational response together. May light shine forth through us today. May light of reason guide our way. May beauty, truth, and joy become a flame that burns in everyone. And John will be doing the children's story this morning.
So if any of the kids want to come up front here, we'll read the story together. Our story this morning is called Clancy the Courageous Cow. And there's a couple little different messages in there, but one of them is things aren't always as they seem, and things can kind of change too, kind of in thinking of our service this morning. So Clancy was born on a stormy day, a day of great disappointment for his parents. You see, they belonged to a herd of belted Galloways, but Clancy had no belt. He was beltless. White there. As Clancy grew up, all the other cows treated him like an outcast. There's Clancy. Imagine being beltless, one of them is saying. Clancy tried hard to give himself a belt. He rolled in the snow, but it soon melted off. He tied a bandage around his middle, but it gave him a tummy ache. He sprinkled sugar on his coat, but the ants drove him crazy. He even painted a white stripe around himself, but it washed off in the rain. Clancy was different, and nothing could be done about it. Nevertheless, his parents loved him dearly. The belted Galloways lived on poor grass, and they were all skinny. They lived next to the field next to them was full of rich grass and fat Herefords. It's a different kind of cow. The Herefords held the grazing rights to their field since they'd won the cow wrestling contest, which was held once a year. You can see them wrestling there? The belted Galloways were trapped in a vicious cycle. The Herefords grew big and strong on the rich grass, so they always won the contest. This gave them grazing rights for another year. Some nights, the belted Galloways tried to sneak into the Herefords' field to graze, but their white belts always glowed in the dark and gave them away. Get out of here, dumb Herefords. One night, Clancy slipped into the Herefords' fields to try his luck, and nobody chased him out. He was invisible in the dark. The next night, as Clancy grazed, he bumped into another cow. "Who is that?" asked Clancy. "I'm Helga," answered the cow. "I am totally brown Hereford." Like Clancy, Helga had always been picked on because she was different. Clancy and Helga hit it off immediately, and they grazed together every night. At first, only Clancy's mom and dad noticed how big he was getting. Then one day he bumped into the president of the belted Galloways and sent her flying. She started to bawl him out, then stopped in amazement. Clancy was enormous. Surely a cow as big as this could win the cow wrestling contest. The very important belted Galloways decided that being beltless was not such a bad thing, and that Clancy would represent the herd at the cow wrestling contest. On the day of the match, Clancy pinned his opponent in record time and won the contest. We have a new champion. Now it was time for the belted Galloways to enjoy the rich grass. They began to chase the Herefords out of the field. Suddenly a voice rang out. It was Clancy. Stop! Helga stood next to Clancy. This situation has gone on for far too long, said Clancy. Black, white, or brown, we're all cows. I say we pull down the fence and be cows together. After a little while, the Belted Galloways and the Herefords begin to get along very well. There was plenty of grass for everybody. Clanga was born on a sunny day, a day of great joy for her parents. And you can kind of see the little calf there is kind of all different colors. So that's our story. And Greg said if you guys want to stay up here for the next song, he's going to lead us in the next song too. The song is number 118, This Little Light of Mine, in the hymnal for everybody else, too. Thank you all. The purpose of the church is to encourage all who gather there to grow more generous in spirit and in action. This is the great end of the world's faith traditions, to bring the human being closer to the divine acts of creation and compassion. We now take an offering that allows us to exercise that all-important generosity of spirit, an offering that will support this self-supporting church and its many ministries. The gifts of the congregation will be most gratefully received. Thank you. we come to our traditional part of our service where we take some time to share our joys and concerns. So if you've got a special joy or a deep concern that you'd like to share, please raise your hand and tell us your name, and the usher will bring you the microphone. I'll start us off by lighting our memorial candle. And I think today a good thing to think about would be, you know, the tensions in the Korean Peninsula, and think about that and if there's why that is, and was there any positive energy we can send that way to something we don't really understand and would like to see more peace.
My name is Sue, and I have a joy. My only grandson is going to be a big brother in June, so my daughter and son are expecting again.
I'm Yvonne, and I'd like a candle of joy for the greatest cookie sale in the world. And it was truly an amazing event because many of us had never experienced that many cookies in one spot. And some very creative ones as well. But the real joy was the sense of community from this church, all the many bakers and the people who help package and sell, and it really felt like a group effort and with wonderful results. So a candle of joy.
I got sweets. Can you make me a candle?
I think Caleb is trying to say he'd like to light a candle of joy for the music today.
My name is Chris. Would you light a candle of concern for a young friend who hit some ice on the way to her grandmother's, going to Iowa on her way for Thanksgiving, and she's in a coma in Mayo Clinic?
I'm Al, and a candle of joy that my daughter Hillary is back with us for some time. And I extend that out to the cats of the world as well. So nice to see the graduates of our RE program back with us this time of year. Also a candle of concern, if you will, kind of a convoluted, challenging web, if you will. My sister's ex-husband is diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And the relationship is strained such that my sister can't really be involved, although she's hurting. And then they have 3 children, so a lot of challenge there.
Hi, I'm Lynn. A couple candles of joy. One for our minister, Reverend Jane Espenson, who announced last week that she'll be getting married next month in Sweden, and she'll finish out the year with us and then move to Sweden. So we'll share in her joy. And also a candle of joy because it's getting time to start thinking really seriously about this solar installation that we'd like to put on the church grounds. There'll be a congregational meeting next Sunday after the service, so we can explore that a little bit more together and vote on that. So.
I'd like to light a candle of concern for my mother, who broke her hip last week, and seems like she's gone through just a whole string of falls and breaks and stuff, and it's pretty hard for her to take. And then, okay.
please light our candle of joy that our Thanksgiving potluck was a success. We've fed 130 people, and thank God Barbara is there to run it and with her expertise. Thank you. And everybody that donated food and cooked and volunteered for setup, again, we are so lucky to have great volunteers in this congregation. Thank you.
I have joy and concern. My mother-in-law, Hazel, died last Monday evening, and it was a very long journey. She was one of my greatest teachers. She will be sorely missed. I was able to walk her all the way home, and she's now out and beyond. She went on a moonlit night, and the stars were shining. And she brought a lot of joy, and we will miss her now.
And I'll light one last candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts today. Our meditation words come from Reverend Linda Hansen, whom some of you, or most of you, have probably met when she has done a couple services here. Let us enter into a spirit of meditation. Much of our human struggle is with what we do not know or understand. It is often difficult not to want answers, or even more difficult, not to think we have them already. May we experience what we do not know, not as an individual failure, but as an invitation to community. May we seek not the true answers so much as the true questions, knowing that true questions make of our lives meaningful, even if sometimes restless journeys. May we be grateful for the restless voices in our communities. Let us take a few moments of silence to listen for the restless voices within ourselves. May we be of good company to one another in our questions and our journey. So may it be.
Why not you?
When we chose this particular service, as has been mentioned, it was based on or inspired by this book called Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic by Bart Kosko. So after I went through the sermon, I thought it would be interesting to look at the book a little bit, and I got some readings from that book that I thought were kind of interesting and having to do with things not always being as they seem, that things can change, and, you know, the world isn't really black and white. So from the book by Bart Kosko, "We know things change. Science reveals a world of jagged edges and quantities that vary smoothly. More precision does not take the gray out of things. It pins down the gray. Medical advances have not made it easier to draw the line between life and not life at birth or death. If we describe the Earth's atmosphere molecule by molecule, we would still find no line that divides the atmosphere from space. Detailed maps of the surface of Earth and Mars and the Moon do not tell us where the hills end and the mountains begin. Yet in much of our science, math, logic, and culture, we have assumed a world of blacks and whites that does not change. Every statement is either true or false. Every molecule in the cosmos belongs to your finger or not. Every law, statute, and club rule applies to you or not. The digital computer with its high-speed binary strings of ones and zeros stands as the emblem of the black and white and its triumph over the scientific mind. This faith in the black and the white, this bivalence, if you will, reaches back in the West to at least the ancient Greeks. Democritus reduced the universe to atoms and to void. Plato filled his world with the pure forms of redness and rightness and triangularity. Aristotle took time off from training his pupil, Alexander the Great, to write down what he felt were the black and white laws of logic, laws that scientists and mathematicians still use to describe and discuss the gray universe. Aristotle's binary logic came down to one law, A or not A, either this or not this. The sky is blue or it's not blue. It can't be both blue and not blue. It can't be A and not A. Aristotle's law defined what was philosophically correct for over 2,000 years. This binary faith of it is or it isn't has always faced doubt. It has always led to its own critical response, a sort of logical and philosophical underground. The Buddha lived in India 5 centuries before Jesus and almost 2 centuries before Aristotle. The first step in his belief system was to break through the black and white world of words, pierce that bivalent veil, and see the world as it is, see it filled with contradictions, with things and not things, with roses that are both red and not red, with A and not A. You find this fuzzy or gray theme in Eastern belief systems, old and new, from Lao Tse's Taoism to the modern Zen in Japan. Either or versus contradiction. A or not A versus A and not A. Aristotle versus the Buddha. And then with regard to ethics, science is the measure of all things. It measures the universe and its pieces with telescopes, microscopes, speedometers, spectrometers, barometers, electrocardiograms, and breathalyzers. And we measure ideas against science. Science favors a lean diet and exercise and washing your hands. It does not favor ideas that don't fit with natural selection or the Big Bang or the second law of thermodynamics. Science has all but ended astrology and philosophy and religion. Now, he wrote this in 1993, so I'm not quite sure that follows, but they live on as shells of what they once were. So what about ethics? Does science dispose of morals and law and the social contracts that we live by? I think the answer is fuzzy, yes and no. In some sense, reason always ends in doubt. Each day, more facts pour in, and our measurements of the world get more precise. So issues blur, and our view gets fuzzier. Everything causes every other thing to some degree. Tobacco smoke and burnt food and sunshine and asbestos and TV sets cause cancer to some degree. A million forces in the economy help warm the planet and eat its thin atmosphere. A million forces in our brains and bodies and genes shape our thoughts and choices and behavior. Each day it gets harder to call one thing or one event or act good or bad or call it right or wrong. The lines blur into curves. Reason ends in doubt. What starts out black and white ends up gray. Fuzzy logic is a part of science. It came late, but it came. So what does it say about ethics? You may not like it, in a sense that I will explain. Science has disposed of ethics. We have no final argument but force against the young men who run through Dostoevsky novels and shout, "Everything is permitted." On top of this, fuzzy logic blurs the idea of ethics. Each act is to some degree intentional and determined. Each law admits degrees and spectrum of exceptions. Up close, the social contract shades into gray and frays into whatever you want it to be. Science undercuts ethics because we have made science the measure of all things. Truth means truth of science. Truth means logical truth or factual truth. Truth means math proof or data test. The truth can be a matter of degree, but that does not help ethics.
Some of you may have heard Garrison Kaler's Thanksgiving story in which Unitarians are featured. Somebody needs to find out what Kaler's experience is with Unitarians. He mentions us frequently, and I might add, usually his comments, whether complimentary or critical, are right on the money. In this story, he describes a Lake Wobegon family visiting relatives back east for the holidays and mentions that the relatives are Unitarians. Then he says something like this: "A lot of folks say Unitarians have no beliefs. That is not true. Unitarians have very strong beliefs. It is just that those beliefs, depends upon what book they last read." We are, it is true, often criticized this way. When it comes to religious belief, it is hard to pin down Unitarian Universalists. Sometimes we are criticized, and rightly so, for having no beliefs. Sometimes we are criticized, and rightly so, for having too many beliefs, that we believe anything we want. Sometimes those criticisms are appropriate, sometimes they're not. See what I mean about it being hard to pin us down? The whole subject of Unitarian Universalist beliefs is a fuzzy one. The problem with this line of criticism is that in addition to it being true, it is also mostly misguided and irrelevant. Unitarian Universalism is not a religion that is centered around a common religious belief system. A common religious belief system is sometimes called a creed and has been uniformly resisted and opposed throughout our history. Though we do not have a uniformly held religious beliefs system, I am convinced that we hold a fairly uniform religious value system like that expressed in our covenant. Values are quite different from creeds, but that is grist for a different sermon mill, I'm afraid. To say we don't hold uniform beliefs does not mean we do not hold beliefs. On the contrary, most Unitarian Universalists I know, as individuals, have very strong opinions about all manner of subjects, and most are not shy about expressing them. The problem is that our beliefs aren't consistent from one person to the next. Most Unitarian Universalists I know have not held the exact set of beliefs over the course of their lifetimes, but have shifted and altered and modified their beliefs as time has passed, and most are not embarrassed to admit it. If the topic of discussion is Unitarian Universalist beliefs, the conversation is bound to be a fuzzy one. Our beliefs change from person to person at any one time, and our beliefs change from time to time for any one person. I have long seen this fuzziness as a strength, not a weakness. We humans are not omnipotent, and we form our beliefs based on the best information we have. If we are being responsible about our beliefs, they are bound to be altered in light of new information and new insights. We tend to agree with the French existentialist philosopher Simone de Beauvoir, who wrote, "To say that life is ambiguous is to assert that its meaning is never fixed, that it must constantly be one." When I say I have long felt this way, that our fuzziness of belief is a strength and not a weakness, I can prove it. Any honest assessment of human experience must acknowledge its ambiguous nature. There is beauty in ambiguity. The reason we Unitarian Universalists resist the rigidity of religious creed, the reason for honoring tolerance and valuing an open mind, is that so much of experience is ambiguous. Simple answers to difficult questions may be reassuring, but they rarely reflect the complexity of experience. I am naturally suspicious of any answer, especially a religious answer, that is presented as certain, absolute, and simple. I am more open to answers if they are presented as tentative. Some years ago, when I was a seminary student, I praised ambiguity because it seemed to more accurately reflect human experience as I knew it. I praised it because it seemed to be the only honest way to live. I praised it because, like art, ambiguity lends itself to the aesthetic richness of interpretation. I praised it because its alternatives, various forms of certainties, were unacceptable. This morning I can praise ambiguity for all those reasons, but I have a new one to add to the list. In addition to its consistency with the human psyche, in addition to its beauty of interpretation, in addition to it being a cornerstone of the free mind, ambiguity, I have now discovered has the added value of being true. It is not just that we experience the world ambiguously. The world is ambiguous. This time, however, I have a new and improved word. I have traded the word ambiguous for the word fuzzy. It is a much more common sense expression of the same idea. I encountered this new word and this new insight from a member of All Souls who, a few months ago, recommended a book entitled Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. The author is Bart Kosko, a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California. One interesting part of this book that I will not discuss is Kosko's claim that fuzzy logic makes computers smarter. But what is new and intriguing in this book, at least for me, is not the justification that our vague opinions are valid simply because the human mind can't be certain about things, but rather the conclusion that our vague or fuzzy or ambiguous opinions may be justified because the word world itself is a fuzzy world. Religious fundamentalisms are part of the natural product of certainty. They are the consequence of a belief that what we know is actually the way things are. But absolutisms of certainty are not limited to religious ideas. One finds absolutists in nearly every field of knowledge, including every branch of the sciences, whenever someone presents an idea that is beyond all doubt. I have long admired John Dewey's 1929 Gifford lectures, which were published under the title The Quest for Certainty. In those lectures, Dewey questions all absolutisms, religious, philosophical, and scientific, with the argument that the human mind is fallible and subject to all manner of influence that can skew its understanding. Here is one way he says it. The world as we experience it is a real world, but that is not, in its primary phase, a world that is known, a world that is understood, and is intellectually coherent and secure. In other words, the human mind can get it wrong, so we can never be content that the ideas and opinions we form about the world are fully certain. Any fundamentalism or absolutism or rigid doctrine about life is only as reliable as the fallible human mind, including mine. The quest for knowledge is a legitimate quest, for we can learn new insights and improve our understanding, but the quest for certainty is always, ultimately, illusory. This is where I was 13 years ago on the subject of ambiguity. We can never be absolutely certain about anything because the human mind makes mistakes. What Bart Costco adds to this conversation is that the quest for certainty is thwarted not just because the mind is fuzzy, but because the world itself is fuzzy too. From the time of the Greeks, we have been misled into believing that statements about the world must be either true or false, right or wrong. Either ocean tides are controlled by the moon or they aren't. Either an apple is red or it isn't. Either gravity holds water in a cup or it doesn't. We have turned statements of facts into idols about which there can be no doubt. The earth is flat, we once said with certainty, and the sun moves around it. The earth is round, we later said, with equal certainty, and it moves around the sun. The earth is egg-shaped or pear-shaped is a later certain conclusion, and the sun is not a sun, but is a star. What all these statements have in common is that they were each propositions that were true or false, right or wrong. They were not just estimates or guesses. They were statements of fact. The prevailing assumption of Western thought is that all statements must be true or false, completely true or completely false, with no degrees in between. Our thinking left no room for something to be partially true or partially false, black and white, with no shades of gray. But it turns out, after many centuries of working with this mistaken notion, that our statements about the world are only approximations, more or less right. All statements fall somewhere on a continuum between true and false, right and wrong. There is still some truth in the statement, the earth is flat. It is just that there is not very much truth in it. The earth we plant a garden patch on is flat, but it is only a very small part of the earth. If you connect it to the bigger parts of the earth, you see that it is really round. The statement, the earth is flat, has an extremely small truth value. The statement, the earth is round, has a significantly larger truth value. But there is more truth value if we say, instead of round, that the earth's shape resembles an egg or a pear. Egg-shaped or pear-shaped seems to have an even larger value, which is said to say more true, but it is not absolute or certain truth. Any statement we make about anything in the world is necessarily fuzzy or vague, although some statements are much fuzzier than others. All statements about reality are statements of degree. Are rocks hard? Well, more or less, but usually more. Some rocks more so than others. Is the sky blue? Well, more or less, but usually more. Is snow cold? Well, more or less, but usually more. Is snow warm? Well, more or less, but usually less, and so on. Reality is not black and white choices, but always shades of gray. Costco says it in this way. The fuzzy view says that almost all truth is gray truth, partial truth, fractional truth, fuzzy truth. Math, by the way, is the only exception. Math is the only thing that is either true or false, black or white. But then, math statements have nothing to do with the world. They only tell us about numbers. Costco quotes Einstein as one of the great prophets of fuzzy thinking when he observed that, so far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they are not certain. And so far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. From this, it would seem that Einstein embraced a very fuzzy reality. Fuzzy thinking means simply acknowledging that the truth about everything in the world is a matter of degrees, shades of gray. Costco describes asking audiences to raise their hands in response to the questions, how many of you are tall? How many of you are honest? How many of you are rested? There is no definite answer, only fuzzy answers to such questions. People are more or less tall, more or less honest, more or less rested. Some are much more and some are much less of each. Though ancient Greeks like Aristotle taught us to think in terms of certainty, they could also have taught us fuzzy thinking. Costco notes that Zeno's great paradoxes were models for fuzzy thinking. Zeno instructs us, for example, to look at a pile of sand and ask ourselves if it is a pile. Yes, it is. Take away one grain of sand. Is it still a pile? Yes. Take away another grain and ask the question, and then a third, a fourth, a fifth grain. Take away thousands each time asking the question, is there a point at which it is no longer a pile? Will it be a pile of sand when there are two grains left, or one grain, or no grains? The statement, this is a pile of sand, is a fuzzy statement because there's no way of determining exactly when it is and when it isn't a pile of sand. Bertrand Russell, whom Costco identifies as one of the early prophets of fuzz, though he called it vagueness, did the same procedure with baldness. Personally, know that very well. Take away one hair from the head, then another. When does one become bald? Now, I know that all these are mind tricks and are not everyone's cup of tea, and I want to assure you that before I go any further, that there is, in fact, a point I want to make with all this. For those of you who don't care to play the word games I've been playing, please know that I hope to make this all relevant before I finish. I do know that there are some of you, though, who, like me, enjoy these sorts of games, so I give you one more example to play with. This one comes not from Costco, but from James Glick, in his book, Chaos. It is an example that troubled me for quite a long time before I read about fuzzy thinking. Glick tells the story of Benoit Mandelbrot, a mathematician who asked the very sensible question, how long is the coast of Britain? So he imagined measuring it. Take a picture from an airplane or a satellite and use reference points to measure it, and you'll get a measurement. But you'll miss all the subtleties of small inlets. So you will need to get closer and measure the inlets, and your measurement will be longer. If you get close enough, you'll see the water flowing around large boulders that jut out into the bays. So you'll need to measure around the boulders, and your measurements will be longer. But the coastline includes not just boulders, but also rocks and pebbles, and you'll need to measure the water flow around them, and your measurement will get longer. And don't forget the grains of sand. And the grains of sand contain a molecular structure that juts out just as boulders jut out. They're much smaller, but they still could be measured. At each level, the more precise the measurement, the longer the length of the coastline. Glick says that Mandelbrot found that as the scale of measurement becomes smaller, the measured length of a coastline rises without limits, and peninsulas, reading ever smaller sub-bays and sub-peninsulas, at least down to atomic scales, where the process does finally come to an end, perhaps. In this imaginary measurement process, each step towards precision reveals how much more still needs to be measured. Each attempt to be precise reveals how imprecise the answer is. In Costco's book, he says that precision increases fuzziness. He quotes his own teacher, Lofty Zadeh, chair of the engineering department at the University of California, Berkeley, who said, "The closer one looks at a real-world problem, the fuzzier becomes its solution." It is time now, I suppose, to leave the mind games that I find intriguing in Costco's book and try to find a principle or a value that they point to. The reason for presenting these various mental exercises is simply to illustrate Costco's thesis that fuzzy thinking is justified because the world that we seek to understand is a fuzzy world, not a precise and certain one. There is, I admit, a grave danger in embracing this fuzzy thinking. If all our knowledge is fuzzy because the world that we know is fuzzy, it would be easy and mistaken to conclude that it doesn't matter what we believe. What we believe isn't going to be precisely certain anyway, and we aren't going to get it right no matter what we do. This is the complaint, you will recall, that is often lodged against Unitarian Universalists. It doesn't matter what they believe. UUs can believe anything they want. Does fuzzy thinking inevitably lead us to such philosophical and theological apathy or nihilism? Does our inability to know anything for certain trivialize what we believe about the human soul, or about the purpose of life, or about the meaning of death, or about right and wrong, good and evil, or about God, or about anything of importance? This is not, it seems to me, the lesson to be gained from understanding fuzzy thinking. Fuzzy thinking is not about getting things right, but about getting things right more or less. This is not because fuzzy answers are some kind of consolation prizes to make up for our inability to know things for sure. Rather, we value fuzzy answers because they are the right answers to fuzzy questions. If questions about rocks and coastlines are fuzzy, how much more fuzzy must the answers be about questions concerning the meaning of life? We hold beliefs because we want answers that are right, more or less. The task is to keep working at it until we are more and more right. Garrison Keillor's characterization of us was accurate. All folks say that Unitarians have no beliefs. That is not true. Unitarians have very strong beliefs. It is just that what those beliefs are depends on what book they last read. It is both a criticism and a compliment, and it affirms a certain fuzziness in the positive sense of that word at the heart of who we are. We usually call it a search for truth. We sometimes even call it a religious journey. Whatever we call it, we will look forward to the next book, the next encounter, the next conversation, expecting our ideas to be more clearly formed and more adequate than before. Our religious values teach an openness to new ideas and views. That value suggests an inherent uncertainty and tentativeness, a fuzziness. If we were certain about our truths, we'd have no use for open-mindedness. And there's one other aspect worth mentioning. Consider the statement cited earlier by the engineering professor Lofty Zadeh. The closer one looks at a real-world problem, the fuzzier becomes the solution. This is why I suggest that most Unitarian Universalists are suspicious not only of rigid answers, but simplistic ones. The religious journey and search for truth continue, and in the next leg of that journey, I will not be afraid of fuzzy questions or fuzzy answers.
One of our favorite topics, being born again. morning I was born again. Light shines on my land. I no longer look for heaven in your deathly distant land. I do not want your pearly gates. I want your streets of gold. This morning I was born again. The light shines in my soul. This morning I was born again. Born again complete. I stood up above my troubles. I stand on my two feet. My head, it feels unlimited. My body feels like the sky. Feeling home in the universe. Beyond the planets fly. This morning I was born again. My past is dead and gone. This great eternal moment is my great eternal dawn. Each drop of blood within me, each breath of life I breathe, is united with these valleys and the valleys with the trees. This morning I was born again. The light shines on my land. I no longer look for heaven in your deathly distant land. I give myself, my heart, my soul, to give some friend a hand. Morning, I was born again. I am in the promised land. This morning, I was born again. I am in the promised land.
John gathered some words for me to say for closing words, and I don't have them with me. So I was just going to say we can open it up either to talk about the sermon here or continue in the meeting hall. It's your choice. I don't see any flying hands. Okay. 5 minutes. Okay.
This is Al. I do very much appreciate Garrison Keillor. I enjoy his humor and I enjoy his digs. But in listening to what was presented today, I started to reflect on the two sides of definition. And in my simplistic manner, is it important for me to define what I think, what I believe? Yeah, probably. It can help direct me. But do I have to define that exactly? Probably not. Does my internal reflection give me pause and ability for growth and new perspective? Certainly. On the other side, when others want to define what I believe, or perhaps more universally get me to define what members of this congregation believe or Unitarian Universalists believe, I don't know the value there. It would seem, going back to the black and white theme of the conversation, that the purpose of the question is comfort that they, speaking they, someone outside asking the question, they can define it and say, okay, that's right or that's wrong, or I get it or I don't. So I often struggle with that, what do you believe, what's it all about, from someone who has not been involved in our approach. And I guess I've become a little jauntist. I don't know if it's threatened or frustrated or angry, but when someone says, "What do you believe?" Maybe the fuzzy logic is the non-emotional answer.
My name is Mike. I realize that I've read Aristotle in English translations. I've had a very small smattering of classical Greek, but I would never pretend to try to read a primary document like Aristotle's Metaphysics or his Ethics in classical Greek, because I just wouldn't get through it. But even in the translation, I have fairly decent confidence that the translations I've been reading are pretty good. And he opens up the ethics, the Nicomachean Ethics, with the statement that we ought to give precision to subjects, only the degree of precision to a subject that it will allow for. And he begins the ethics with that statement to say that, we're not going to be able to get precision talking about what's right and wrong. He himself was a proponent of fuzzy thinking in his own way. I'm bringing all this up only because I get kind of tired of the Aristotle bashing, and he said something else besides A equals A and the principle of identity. And the fact that we are Westerners, I think that we find Eastern thought fascinating because it's so foreign to us, and it has kind of a magical quality, but the Buddha wasn't right about everything. And I think that since we're into accepting things as being what they are, gray and fuzzy, that we ought to perhaps pursue our own study of our own Western tradition with the idea that these people are not right or wrong. They have some truths. And to my mind, the Greeks had a lot of truth. They erred perhaps on the side of being a little bit too dogmatic, but that's just from our modern standpoint. That's how they spoke in the ancient world. They only had, so many years on this planet. And they were trying to set up contrasts between saying something is this way and it's not that way to try to clarify a thought. And that's pretty much the way the Greeks did it. You'd make a statement positive and then you'd say, this is what a thing is, but this is what it's not. What it's become in the 21st century, obviously, is, I think, something of a distortion. So this is just my little sermon to for us to be fair to the poor Greeks. They're dead after all.
They're after all. They are dead after all, and we are all living. And I think the most important thing, rather than trying to constrict and narrow and focus, that we open our hearts and our minds to all of life all around us and consider things as they come. Thank you all very much. Have a good morning. We're just one last word because I didn't say anything about Thanksgiving, but let's not forget how thankful we are for the life that we live.
In my thoughts again. yesterday, where friends and family gathered for the Lord. There an old-fashioned preacher taught the straight and narrow way for what few corns a congregation could afford. Dressed in all our Sunday best, we sat on pews of solid oak, and I remember how our voices filled the air. How Karma sounded like an angel on those high soprano notes. When the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word to base my life upon. At the all-day Sunday singing and dinner on the ground, many were the souls that were revived. While the brothers and the sisters who'd gone on to glory land slept in peace in the maple grove nearby. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word to base my life upon. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word to base my life upon. My heart